It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
CIA chief defends interrogations after 2001 attacks. And death toll tops 30 after double blast in central Nigeria. I'm Bill Michaels in Washington. The chief of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency is defending its use of enhanced interrogation techniques in confronting suspected terrorists after the 2001 attacks against the United States. In a rare news conference at agency headquarters, CIA Director John Brennan said Thursday that the tactics provided useful information to the country to thwart more attacks and capture al-Qaeda terrorists. He disputed a lengthy U.S. Senate report this week that the harsh questioning tactics yielded no worthwhile intelligence and that they amounted to torture. Brennan praised the overwhelmingly majority of the agency's intelligence operatives for their efforts after the September 11th attacks that killed nearly 3,000 people.
They did what they were asked to do in the service of our nation.
Former U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney says the CIA did exactly what the White House wanted in setting up the interrogation program. Nigerian officials say two explosions in the central city of Jos have killed at least 31 people. A National Emergency Management Agency spokesman says two bombs were detonated within a few minutes of each other in the Jos main market in front of a fast food restaurant. The blast occurred around 6:30 p.m. local time Thursday evening, just meters away from where a twin car bombing in May left at least 118 other people dead. This is VOA News. An al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen says it carried out a rocket attack Thursday on an airbase used by the United States. Yemeni officials confirmed the strike on the Al-Anad facility. A spokesman for the Yemeni embassy in Washington reported there were no fatalities. The Pentagon said no U.S. military personnel were injured. Earlier this week, al-Qaeda claimed two suicide car bombings on a military base that killed 7 Yemeni soldiers. One last group of Hong Kong protesters chanted, "We'll be back," Thursday, as police dismantled the remaining barricades that were part of the Central Business District during pro-democracy demonstrations that lasted almost 3 months. Bill Hyde has our story from Beijing.
Hong Kong authorities had voiced concerns about possible violence as they moved to clear tents and barricades from the city streets and end the biggest protests the Chinese government has seen in more than 2 decades. That did not happen. Those who did stay were arrested by police. Public disapproval of the methods protesters have used does not necessarily equal opposition to what they are fighting for. The right to select and elect their top leader without any interference from Beijing. Despite weeks of protests, China has shown no signs that it is willing to make any compromises. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has appointed a new head of the United Nations Mission for Ebola Emergency Response, spokesman Stephane Dujarric.
The Secretary General appointed today Ismail Ould Sheikh Ahmed of Mauritania as his new special representative and head of the United Nations Mission for Ebola Emergency Response, known as UNMIR, at the Undersecretary General level. In his role, the special representative will work closely with the special envoy on Ebola, Dr. David Nabarro, and with the governments in the region and other partners.
The UN says he has more than 28 years of development and humanitarian assistance experience with the United Nations in Africa, the Middle East, and Eastern Europe. One of the strongest West Coast storms in years hit Northern California Thursday, drenching the region with as much as 13 centimeters of rain, accompanied by 230-kilometer wind gusts. The storm closed schools and disrupted normal life in San Francisco, flooding highways and knocking out power to hundreds of thousands. Some commuter train and subway stations were also forced to shut down. Reporting from Washington, I'm Bill Michaels, and this is VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA. Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington, sitting in for the vacationing James Batty. Today is Friday, December 12th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. One of Zimbabwe's newly appointed vice presidents says he is not afraid of report of an attempt on his life.
Threats to my life are normal. I reduced throughout my 62 years of political life. It has become part of my life.
Emmerson Mnangagwa is one of Zimbabwe's newly appointed vice presidents. Meanwhile, Mr. Mnangagwa and his colleague, Vice President Ambassador Pikeleza Mpoko, will be sworn in today, Friday. And Sierra Leone's information minister is unhappy about exaggerated figures of citizens infected with the dreaded Ebola disease.
The huge numbers that seem to be coming out on the wires don't seem to be reflecting on the ground. But part of the explanation for that is that these huge numbers are swelled up.
Alpha Kanu is Sierra Leone's Minister of Information. While South Africa's ruling ANC rescue energy giant Eskom, which is expected to soon go bankrupt, will have a report. And some South Sudanese call for a new constitution as part of an effort to restore peace in the world's newest nation. Those stories, plus Mark Omer's sport and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zimbabwe's Deputy President Emmerson Mnangagwa is on cloud nine following his appointment to a position he has coveted for years. Viewed by many as a hardliner in President Robert Mugabe's ZANU-PF, Mr. Mnangagwa is now most likely to succeed President Robert Mugabe, who turns 91 in February. The 68-year-old Mnangagwa has served in Mr. Mugabe's government since 1980 and is viewed as one of his most trusted lieutenants. VOA Zimbabwe service reporter Sandra Nyaira spoke with Mr. Mnangagwa about his appointment.
Well, happy, but with humility. The task is onerous, and I have to fulfill the aspirations of our people and the expectations of my party.
So much has been happening, Mr. Mnangagwa, prior to this appointment in terms of factionalism and lately alleged threats on your life. What do you think about these threats on your life? Do you have anything to say about that?
Threats to my life are normal. I reduced throughout my 52 years of political life. It has become part of my life.
Many people, Mr. Mnangagwa, would want to really know who really is Emmerson Mnangagwa.
He's a villager from Zishayani, brought up by the revolution, and continues to serve his country as a revolutionary.
And in terms of the people of Zimbabwe and their aspirations, the burning issue for most of them right now is the state of the country's economy. What is your role, or what is your role going to be in terms of taking the country forward in terms of improving the economy?
Governance is never an individual effort. Governance is a collective effort. I will continue to contribute in the collective aspect of our governance.
What would you say is top of the list of the things that you would want to address as the first vice president of Zimbabwe? Obviously, you have issues that you have looked at since you joined the liberation struggle, that you have always had a burning desire to say you want to see this addressed for the nation of Zimbabwe. If you can just share with us.
Is to assist my president in the implementation of Zim Asset, because that addresses the needs and aspirations of our people across the board.
Over the years, there have been reports pitting you against the former Vice President Joyce Mujuru as rivals fighting to succeed President Robert Mugabe when he retires. What is your relationship with Mrs. Mujuru and all those issues and all those stories that we were reading? Were they true by any chance?
No. Comrade Mujuru and myself are really colleagues, armed struggle colleagues and comrades. And there's nothing of any enmity between me and her. You can also interview her. She'll tell you the same.
Emmerson Mnangagwa is one of the newly appointed vice president. He spoke with VOA Zimbabwe service Sandra Nyaira. Meanwhile, Embassy Mnangagwa and former envoy to South Africa, Ambassador Pilekezela Mpoko, are scheduled to be officially installed today, Friday, as the long-term President Robert Mugabe names a new cabinet, and speculation persists on who might succeed the 90-year-old leader. Alex Megaisa, a lecturer at Kent University in London, told me that Zimbabweans are still in shock over the dismissal of former Vice President Joyce Mujuru.
This obviously follows the very significant changes that have taken place in ZANU-PF, which have therefore affected the leadership structure in Zimbabwe.
Why choose two instead of one? They appear not to have any significant powers to challenge him in any way.
Well, there is a historical dimension to this whole issue of the number of vice presidents in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe went through a terrible time in the 1980s when there was almost a civil war between the two main political parties. They then joined together, ZANU-PF and PF-ZAPU, to become ZANU-PF, headed by President Mugabe.
What do you think is next for Mrs. Mujuru after she was kicked out? Now she can't even compete in the power structures of the ZANU-PF anymore. What's next for her?
Well, it's difficult to say at this early stage. I think it has come as a shock to most people, because if you asked any Zimbabwean in the middle of the year who would become President Mugabe's successor, I think most people would have said Joyce Mujuru. She was almost there. But unfortunately, you know, there has been a palace coup, essentially. Mr. Mnangagwa has managed to get in front of her, and he is now the heir apparent to President Mugabe. What's next for her? There are two choices. Either she opts out and decides to challenge President Mugabe or his replacement. But she would also have to consider the costs and benefits of moving out of ZANU-PF. In many cases, ZANU-PF has a file on each and every member of that political party, and all the crimes and shenanigans that you may have committed during your tenure will be brought up as soon as you decide to challenge the power structures.
So you think she has an opportunity of a political Lazarus in Zimbabwe's politics?
Well, you know what? You can never say never. One of the reasons why she has been pushed out was because she had become a significant threat to President Mugabe. She controlled the bulk of the party, and all those people who had been elected, who were supporting her, were thrown out as part of the move to remove her. So she does control a large constituency within ZANU-PF, and indeed she has managed to gain a lot of sympathy among a lot of Zimbabweans with the way that she has been treated and the way that she has carried herself during her trials and tribulations, regardless of the fact that most Zimbabweans do not believe that ZANU-PF people are innocent or that she is corruption-free herself. But she has gained some sympathy out of this whole episode. So she remains a threat, although she is now without power, or rather the authority of the state.
Alex Magaisa is a lecturer at Kent University. He spoke with me from London. The World Health Organization says a new Ebola outbreak in Sierra Leone has killed dozens of people and sickened more than 100. But a Sierra Leone government spokesman says those numbers are too high. Christian Stein reports from Nigeria's capital, Abuja.
Sierra Leone's Minister of Information, Alpha Kanu, hit back Thursday at media reports of a new outbreak. In a teleconference with journalists, he says the WHO's announcement that an outbreak in the remote Kono district has killed 87 people and sickened 123 was based on improper counting of Ebola casualties.
The huge numbers that seem to be coming out on the wires don't seem to be reflecting on the ground. But part of the explanation for that is that these huge numbers are swelled up by tests carried out on people who are already dead, i.e. the swabs. Because we have a policy in Sierra Leone that any death now is treated as an Ebola death until proven otherwise.
Since breaking out earlier this year, Ebola has killed more than 6,500 people. Of the three West African countries hardest hit, Ebola now has 7,987 cases, the highest number. Liberia and Guinea have also suffered from the disease. Kanu says his country is treating all deaths as Ebola deaths so that burials, a key way the disease is transmitted, are carried out safely. Health authorities are planning a lockdown of Kono District to assist in fighting that outbreak. Kanu says he expects Sierra Leone to make strong progress against the virus by the end of December.
8 cases have been the highest number that has been reported in one single day in Kono. And that is what has caused the alarm and the alert. So it is not an explosion. They are a containable situation, and the DHMT is already there and on top of the situation, and we are sending teams there to ensure that during the lockdown, people who are sick will be brought out. Yes, we still agree that we will tend to zero by the end of the year.
The World Health Organization has also said Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea are making progress toward the UN goals of treating 100% of Ebola patients and conducting 100% of burials safely. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington. Today is Friday, December 12. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Ahead on our program, Mark Omer Sports and our listener of the day. South Africa is suffering from worsening electricity blackout as state-run utility Eskom falls deeper into crisis. Eskom, which provides South Africa with 95% of its electricity, says it will suffer a massive $21 billion funding shortfall over the next 4 years. The government has promised to bail out Eskom with a partial privatization program, which is likely to result in a fierce backlash from political opponents and trade unions. The ruling African National Congress will have to balance its responsibility to rescue the biggest threat to its economy while limiting political damage. Gillian Parker has more from Johannesburg.
Years of poor maintenance, non-cost-effective tariffs and underinvestment have come back to bite South Africa. That is the assessment of Eskom's chief executive Thadiso Matona, who announced this month that regular power outages are likely to continue for the next year and a half. Eskom is highly monopolistic, controlling power generation, transmission and distribution. In developed markets, this is not usually the case, with various private and government sectors sharing the load. Natasha Michaels, the Opposition Democratic Alliance Shadow Minister of Public Enterprises, says Eskom has had its day.
The main reason that we find ourselves in the crisis that we are in right now is basically due to Eskom having such a complete and total monopoly around the energy production and energy distribution in our country. And I think now more than ever, it's become apparent that this is a very unhealthy relationship.
The ruling African National Congress, ANC, plans a $1.8 billion bailout and to sell $2 billion of non-strategic assets to help bridge Eskom's $21 billion funding shortfall. But that may be interpreted as privatisation. Power privatisation has been discussed at length over the past decade, but the ruling ANC's traditional allies, the Communist Party and powerful trade unions, oppose it ideologically, as does the far-left opposition party, the Economic Freedom Front. So Eskom's detractors are now pushing to see the Independent Services and Market Operator Bill signed into law. ISMO would reduce Eskom's stranglehold over the energy sector by removing the transmission grid from Eskom and placing it in an independent entity that would foster competition. Sean Nell, spokesman for the Energy Intensive Users Group, says the introduction of private independent power producers, or IPPs, is a good political compromise.
Privatisation of Eskom is not ideological palatable, but the use of IPPs, I think, is something which while has been problematic in the past, they've come to realise that they actually can't afford the South African balance sheet to maintain that level of investment. So IPPs, I don't think, are unpalatable, but the breakup of Eskom and privatisation of Eskom definitely is.
Power supply was not always this bad. There was a surplus of electricity in the 1980s, which prompted South Africa to engage with energy-hungry mining, processing and construction industries, and the commodity boom became the main driver of South Africa's economic growth. At the turn of democracy in 1994, South Africa boasted an abundant supply of the world's cheapest electricity. Today, Eskom is in a financial hole, says energy expert Chris Yelland, who says diversifying energy sources is the only lasting answer.
Ideologically, the government is kind of hamstrung through its partnership with Labour and its partnership with the South African Communist Party. I personally believe that Eskom should contemplate selling certain of Eskom assets in order to diversify the electricity sector of South Africa and raise the money in that way. But as I say, ideologically, it appears almost impossible that that would happen. Then the economy is going to suffer from a failing electricity sector. So in a way, you know, money is the final deciding factor. Money will trump ideology, ultimately.
In the face of sluggish economic growth and rolling blackouts, the ANC's decision to sell government assets will mark a stark shift in policy, and the political implications may be as uncertain as the nation's power supply. Gillian Parker for VOA News, Johannesburg.
At a United Nations and Sud Institute-sponsored debate entitled South Sudan's Peace Process and the Role of Regional and International Actors, at least one analyst said yesterday he believes a people-centered constitution is the only solution for the nation's challenges and that the ongoing peace talks will not solve South Sudan's problems. Waki Simon Wudu has the story for VOA from Juba.
Sud Institute policy analyst Zakaria Ding Akol says the country's transitional constitution should be scrapped in favor of a brand new constitution that puts the people first.
While the need to end the conflict is of utmost importance, it is equally imperative that we are extremely seized the urgency of designing a better future in our country. This means that the journey needs to start with designing a well-considered constitution which will be instrumental in helping us to manage our affairs and challenges in a better way.
Before the crisis began a year ago, the government established the National Constitution Review Commission to work out a permanent constitution for South Sudan that would replace the transitional one. But a permanent constitution was never written. Akol says part of the reason is the commission was doomed to begin with.
Some of them are heads of commissions, some of them are in the assembly, some of them are leaders of various political parties, some of them are functioning in other institutions in different capacities. And so to give them this work, because they are competing, or there might be competing priorities for them, majority of these people are busy in other positions. This undermines the work of the commission.
Akol also says the transitional constitution has a number of loopholes that fail to address the nation's problems. For example, he says the right of different states to enact different laws often contradict national policy and therefore dilute the constitution. Akol also says the transitional constitution gives too much power to the executive branch, which hampers transparency, accountability, and the rule of law in the country. He says a new constitution should be drafted, one that includes the beliefs of ordinary citizens.
There may be a need to revisit the composition of the NCRC. And among the things that we need to consider is maybe forming a small-sized committee of experts whose sole purposes are, one, to engage the public in order to foster a better understanding as to the relevance of the constitution, and two, to draft the text of the constitution.
Lawyer Lawrence Korbandi, who chairs the South Sudan Human Rights Commission, agrees.
The problem that we have in our constitution is not a constitution that unites us. It's a constitution that divides us. That is why you will find voices talking about powers given to somebody, or powers are given to individuals, or elites are the ones governing the country.
But for Peter Lamboth, the former chairperson of the South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission, the crisis in South Sudan is not the result of poorly written constitution.
The constitution may not be perfect, but it is us to implement what is there and to amend what is not for us. It is about constitutionalism and the implementation of it.
Lam says people of different ethnicities must learn how to peacefully coexist. The crisis began a year ago over a political disagreement between President Salva Kiir and his then-Vice President Riek Machar. Deadly violence quickly spread across the country, most of it along ethnic lines. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu from Juba.
A It's now time for Daybreak Africa Sport. Here's Mark Auma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, Peter. In our Daybreak Africa Sports news, we begin with basketball. Angola and defending champions Primero de Agosto dismissed Tunisia's U.S. Monastir 75-62 as Nigeria's Mark Mentors edged Republic of Congo's ABC 68-65 at the African Men's Club Basketball Championships in the Tunisian capital Tunis on Thursday. Equatorial Guinea's Malabo Kings beat Angola's CDR Libolo 79-69 as Tunisia's Club Africains overwhelmed Mayotte Island's Mtsapere by a staggering 126-45. In athletics, Kenyan Veronica Wanjiru triumphed in the women's 10,000 meters at the Zatopek Classic in Melbourne, Australia on Thursday. Eritrea's Samson Gebreyohannes was third in the men's race. Elsewhere, athletes from Eritrea, Ethiopia, Rwanda, Sudan, Tanzania, Uganda, and Kenya contest the Safaricom Kisumu City Marathon in Western Kenya on Sunday. In rugby, South Africa tackled the United States of America as Kenya encounter Wales in Group A at the start of the third leg of the IRB Sevens series in Nelson Mandela Bay here in South Africa tomorrow Saturday, while Zimbabwe make their first appearance in the series this year when they challenge Argentina, Australia and Portugal in Group B. Turning to football, Algeria's Orange Africa Champions League title holders intensive tackle New Zealand's Auckland City before Mexico's Cruz Azul play Australia's West Sydney Wanderers in the quarterfinals at the FIFA Club World Cup in Rabat, Morocco tomorrow Saturday. In Equatorial Guinea, Republic of Congo play Chad at the Central Africa Economic and Monetary Community CEMAC Cup final in Bata tomorrow Saturday. Prior to the finals, Equatorial Guinea engaged Cameroon in the bronze medal playoff. The competition has been used to test run Equatorial Guinea's preparations to stage the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations starting next month. Finally, hosts Nigeria engage Ghana, then Ivory Coast plays Switzerland at the start of a Four Nations beach soccer tournament in Lagos today, Friday. Tomorrow, Saturday, Nigeria play Ivory Coast as Ghana engage Switzerland, while on Sunday, Nigeria encounter Switzerland before Ghana play Ivory Coast. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a fabulous weekend. Back to you, Peter, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend, and we'll see you again on Monday morning. Here is our listener mail for this Friday morning, December 12.
Good morning. I want to appreciate the governor of Cross River State for the response and wisdom he had in conducting all the elections. That is Governor Luelemo. This is from Cross River State.
Thank you, listener, for your comment. Please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us a message. Well, that's it for this Friday, December 12 edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. Join us again next week for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporter Ricky Shryock, as well as sports editor Mark Auma, and Peter Clotter in Washington, wishing you have a very good weekend.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.